I would just say there's one misperception of our veterans, and that is they are somehow damaged goods. Although if we tell our veterans enough that this is what's wrong with them, then they actually start believing it.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Dead Reckoning Radio. This time around, we have Koki joining us. We talked about where he came from, how he got his name, and what he's up to now. But mostly, we talked about our Christian faith and Christian theology, and his new book, Where They Meet, which is a collection of poetry about his family, his faith, and his relationship with war. We hope you enjoy.
Hey, Koki, how's it going?
What's up? First time caller, long time listener.
Yeah, awesome, man. We're excited to have you on. I know we've been trying to work it out here for the past week or so, but I was on vacation and Keith is having some kid priorities, being a dad and all. So appreciate you fitting it in and us making it work out this night.
No worries, man. Yeah, I mean, I can see Keith's excuse, but yours not so much.
Yeah. I took a long vacation during pretty much a vacation for quarantine, you know.
How's the quarantine treating you?
Oh, man, it's been good, honestly. I was actually just talking to Leo, like, literally today, because we're working on something with him, potentially, and everything, kind of give a little sneak peek. But, no, it's actually been really, really good for me. I've gotten a lot of housework done, got a lot of writing and reading done, and then just spending time with the family. My job doesn't require me to leave my house much as it is. So it's been pretty normal for us.
Yeah. Sounds about right.
Yep. And you?
Yeah, about the same. I had to get I got stuck home from a contract for a few months, so I had to get a job stateside. But before that, I was just, you know, chilling at the house, you know, hanging out with the wife and kids, and, you know, it was awesome. I mean, despite the fact that thousands were dying, I was like, this is great.
I'm really enjoying it. I know. And, yeah, it's hard for me to always know exactly what's going on, because, like, I live in a pretty affluent area and work for a pretty affluent department and everything, so we haven't seen too much of it, and so it's hard for me to see maybe what New York City is seeing or even Dallas in itself is seeing, but, like, man, I don't really see that much of it. But my department just sent some people down to the Hidalgo County border, which is right on Mexico-Texas border, and they're all texting and calling us like, oh, this shit's serious down here, so watch out. And we're like, man, so it's very geographically kind of contained, it seems. But I guess that's why we're doing this, is so it doesn't take over the world. I don't know.
It's right around those 5G networks, man. I'm telling you.
We could definitely get into all that if that's what you want to talk about. But we'll backtrack some. People know you as Koki Actual. We'll keep it at that as much as you want. If you want to talk a little bit about your life prior to Koki, what got you to Koki, and where you've been as Koki, I'll just let you kind of talk freely as much as you want.
Cool, man. Yeah, started off, you know, regular Leave It to Beaver family. My dad was a pastor and my mom was a teacher. So, yeah, it's the definition of the textbook family right there. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I think he was like a fourth generation pastor. Like my grandparents on both sides were pastors, and mm-hmm. my great-grandpa on one side. And I think I would have been a fourth or fifth generation preacher had I stuck with it, because I went to college at a Bible college. I got a degree in preaching ministries.
Really?
And, so as soon as I graduated, with a degree in preaching ministries, I did the next logical choice and joined the Marine Corps and became a scout sniper.
Yeah, what brought you to that conclusion?
Well, that's just the pipeline, bro. It's just how I was going to have that one weird dude in the sniper platoon that's like quoting Bible verses, right?
Oh, yeah. We all know him for sure.
Yeah. No, I was actually going to be a chaplain. I thought, well, if I'm going to be a chaplain, I might as well like get the enlisted experience, understand where the grunts are coming from, and then I can minister to them better. But then I got into a sniper platoon in 2004, and I was like, this is the greatest thing ever. I never want to stop doing this.
Yeah. I'm sure it's pretty fun.
So I played around there for a while. I was in the Marine Corps for 8 years, did some time as a scout sniper instructor in Hawaii, the now defunct schoolhouse. And I got out of the Marine Corps and did contracting. That was a blast. And mm-hmm. I joined the National Guard for about 6 years and I was a medic there. So props to all the other medics out there.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
got a chance to try out for, you know, went to SFAS, didn't really make it, no big deal. I went back to contracting and got over there quick anyway, so.
Yeah, probably even quicker.
Yeah, a lot quicker, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, those guys.
I go play doing the Q course, man. It's like, man, you come over here, man. It's fun.
Yeah, the Delta course, it fast tracking, it's probably 12 to 18 months, and that's fast tracking. So I'm sure you got out there quick and had probably just as much fun.
Yeah, yeah. Not, I mean, yeah, I'm not doing all kinds of kinetic stuff. I'm too old for that stuff now.
Yeah.
Too old for a long
time. Oh, I know that feeling for sure.
I'm too old to be a firefighter. I'm too old to be a cop. I'm too old for a lot of stuff that I was like, yeah, maybe I could fall back on that.
Yeah. No, now you're falling back onto, like we said, writing and thinking, and maybe going to preaching eventually.
Yeah, maybe someday. It's just that pastors, like, unless you're one of those televangelists, and those are few and far between, like, oh, you actually have like a bit of empathy, and they don't make a lot of money, man. Let me tell you, like, I grew up in a pastor's family, and
yeah,
it's not an affluent job.
No, so not at all.
You got to have empathy and stuff. I don't have a whole lot of that, man. Like,
just the Marine Corps beat it out of you.
No, it's not that. I think maybe being a medic beat it out of me, where I'm just like, bro, all your problems are your fault. Like,
yeah.
Drink water. Oh, yeah. My head hurts, doc. Oh, you stupid idiot.
Yeah. Yeah. You probably did something to get your head hurting.
I can't. Well, you're hungover. So here's
something. Yeah. What Bible? You said you went to a Bible college. What college was that?
Went to Cincinnati Bible College, like in the middle of the ghetto.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty sweet. So I got my first taste of inner city life and hated it ever since.
I kind of can relate to that. During my paramedic training, I was in downtown Dallas. And, yeah, it really made me appreciate being out in the burbs a little bit. And, like, I love the action. I had a good time within the Army, being during that medic training and everything, the paramedic training. It's nice when your customers or your patients or whatever are able to articulate their injuries a little bit more, their past medical history that much more. They actually are glad that you're there and have a pretty reasonable conversation with you. It makes
it's not just
a world of difference.
Run.
What's that?
It's not just a Narcan run.
Oh yeah, yep. I had my fair share of those. Even out here, it's kind of, I guess, the stay-at-home moms kind of painkillers, drug of choice around here. So we still deal with it.
Nice. Yeah.
Yep.
For full problems.
Oh yeah. Yeah. This is the definition of it here in Flower Mound. That's for sure. With that though, when you're talking about your parents being a generational preacher, what, denomination did you grow up in?
I grew up non-denominational, and okay, which turned out to be its own denomination later anyway. It's just, I mean,
it's pretty much what it is now.
Yeah. Sola Scriptura. Like, you know, we're just going to go off the Bible and, you know, let's try to figure out as best we can, how did they start the church, and how can we do it like them without all the added traditions and other stuff like that. So, you know.
I like that. I don't know if I've talked about it too much directly on the podcast. I definitely have made hints towards it, but that's what I am, as well, as a non-denominational Christian.
Right on, brother.
That's what I'm talking about. And so we're definitely going to dive deep into that. But the main reason why we pulled you on is where they meet. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. So, well, let me back up and explain the Cokie name. So people, if anybody's wondering why I have a name Cokie and not my real name, it's because that's the deal I had to make to get the book published and, all the other stuff that I've written published. And that's all you get. So
that's why you go under the alias.
Yeah, that's all you get. I was actually got the idea for the name in the National Guard, because ironically, as a guardsman, I end up being a medic for a sniper platoon.
So you knew it probably more better than they did.
I'd certainly been doing it longer, because I did 8 years, you know, from 04 to, you know, 11, you know, some change. And so I've been doing it longer, but those guys, I was actually very, very impressed. I was with the guys from Charlie Troop, and it's like, apparently in the Army, you got this weird thing where you got like a cavalry unit and one company or one troop, whatever it is mm-hmm. infantry, like the 11 Bravos.
Yeah.
And so that's where I got put, which is where I asked to be, which is awesome. I love those guys.
Yeah.
But yeah, I ended up getting put with the sniper platoons, and those guys were like sweet. Like these guys love, I mean, even as their civilian lives, they live to eat, you know, breed sniping, which is
yeah.
awesome.
Well, that's what you would want out of those guys for sure.
So we had to get, like, I guess someone got the idea for call signs. They used to have call signs on deployment that all started with C because they were Charlie Troop, and I was Cokie because I had the drugs.
There you go.
So, that's where it comes from. Yep. And then eventually, I was working a civilian job that was just garbage. I was working in a factory, and it was just a place where souls went to die. And so I started writing there. I had a very good friend of mine on the in my church that kind of encouraged me to start a blog.
Mm-hmm.
So I started doing that, and I was, you know, getting into it. And I think my writing journey really started as Cokie with David Rose. Yeah. I don't know. You've had him on?
We have not had him on. We've talked about having him on. We want him on. He wants us on. Or he wants to come on, but we just haven't made it happen just yet.
Well, him and Leo Jenkins were kind of the guys that were my biggest influences in, you know, as far as the GWAT writers.
Yeah.
But David Rose especially, because I actually had a phone conversation with David Rose, like talking about his book and his writing and things like that. And
which book specifically? Book, oh, yeah, No Joy. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, that was, to me, that is the quintessential GWAT narrative. I love that book so much. Everything about it is perfect to me.
Yeah, no, it's good.
And he was a fantastic writer, but he was also in writing for OAF Nation.
Yep.
And him and you've had Johnny Petticord on there.
Yep.
Who's Grifter and some other guys. Like I spent a lot of time reading their work, and I thought, man, maybe someday.
Yeah.
Maybe someday. But no, that's too big, you know. But then end up hooking up with David Rose, you know, via phone, and he recommended me to be involved in their troop of writers. And so now I've been writing for OAF Nation for a few years now, off and on.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's pretty funny. Like as far as like the writers group, like it's so eclectic, man. They've got like a recon dude, they've got like an intel guy, they've got like a cav officer, and
yeah,
a whole bunch of dudes. And I'm by far the most right wing dude. Like,
yeah, I'm probably sure you are.
Yeah, there's some libertarian guys there. I think Zero Morphine is. I know he's. I'm pretty sure he's a Christian. And
yeah, I'm pretty sure.
I don't know where he leans politically, but yeah, I'm politically like pretty much take who's that guy? King Richard Lionheart.
Keith would probably know this reference. I don't.
The guy who went to the Crusades.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Walking back a little bit. That's where okay. I'm at.
Jeez. All right. Well,
not really. I'm just kidding. But
yeah.
If you've ever heard of Matt Walsh.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. Give him some traps and a gun, and that's where I'm at.
And that's where you're at. There you are. That's pretty funny. Yeah. They've put out tons of good work and tons of good writers recently. And pretty much anything that they put out in the past year or two since I've been following them, 2 years probably now, maybe even three, I'm eating it up, and it's, they usually don't disappoint.
Yeah. My favorite is you know, obviously you got David Rose was my favorite, and you know, Johnny Petticord is Grifter. Zero Morphine just put out this great thing about being a soft medic.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dude named Ryan's Odyssey on Instagram. He actually reviewed my book on OAF Nation. Fantastic.
Yep. I read that one. Yep.
Very honored to have that guy do it. He's a solid writer too.
Yeah, they definitely have done a good job getting a good little network going over there. And what's cool is now is that we're kind of pulling guys from them to get interested in what we're doing. So and you're kind of one of them. So it's awesome. We've had a decent relationship with you now since the Grifter and David Rose days of Kinetic Syndicate and everything. Before that, kind of went on the back burner for a little while, but I didn't realize that was kind of like the genesis of your writing career as well. To see you, and then you sent me some of your personal stuff on your WordPress, more in your Christian writings, to see you go from that to put out this poetry book. And then also you'd probably be one of the most recognized names on the anthology that we put out in love and war, it's been awesome to know that we've been part of that growth.
Oh, dude, yeah, the poetry thing, like, I got the idea from for poetry from again, David Rose put out a poetry book, and I was like, you know, it was from Sands and Time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, dude, I didn't even know you could do that. Put out a poetry book. What the? It was awesome. And then yeah. I read that. And then Leo Jenkins put out With a Pen.
Yep.
And I read that. I'm like, bro, this is insane. Like this. Oh, I got to do one. I had like a really sucky deployment where nothing was going on. Mm-hmm. And I was so bored. So if you want to know why I wrote Where They Meet, it's like I got so bored. I was like, you know what? I'm going to write a book.
Yeah, there you go. Hey, man, we all got to make use of our time somehow.
Yeah, I've written other books before, but this is the first one I published.
Really? What were the other books about?
Well, I wrote one when I was at the factory. Like, my factory job was so disgustingly boring.
Mm-hmm.
And my brain's got to have something to do all the time. So I probably worked like 15 minutes out of every hour at the most. And so I was like, I got to do something. So
yeah. That's
when the blog started. And that's when I wrote a novel about contractors that kind of got stuck out in the middle of nowhere and had to fight their way like an aborted march of the 10,000, you know, the Anabasis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Because I remember thinking, like, what's some of the weird stuff that we as veterans talk about? Like, I remember having like weird conversations about, dude, if there was no Geneva Convention, what's the worst thing you would do to somebody? And we, you know, having that conversation, I was like, dude, what if somebody actually did that?
So I wonder, because like a lot of the civilians, like even here in the fire service, they don't even know what the Geneva Convention is. And then let alone that we still operate underneath it, but our enemy doesn't. And so that right there shows you what people are willing and capable to do. So I kind of, you do that and then times it. And any other twisted way you want, that's your answer.
And then
I think medics in themselves too, they just get that much more of a twisted imagination because we just know how the human body works just to that much more of an nth degree.
I've actually got one of the characters on my book was a medic, and that being a medic really helped kind of solidify some of the stuff that he would do and say, but it's nothing more than like basic trauma. As a medic, I didn't really get too much into that career field, and mm-hmm. I kind of wish I did, but I spent so much time deployed as a contractor that I'd come back and I would miss a drill. So I'd have to make it up some other time. And I'd spend time like mopping floors and organizing the armory or something.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't spend a lot of time being a medic, so I wasn't really good at it.
Yeah.
You know?
It's a fun job. I love it. It's fun, especially when you're with an infantry platoon. Like, that's not platoon. I was with just ground infantry guys, and man, they love you, and it's pretty crazy what responsibility I had at 19, 20 years old, and then to where I'm at now. And it's like, man, I feel like I was more responsible back then, and I'm still doing some pretty crazy stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. You gotta, I mean, for your listeners, like your basic Army medic and your Navy corpsman is allowed to do a lot of stuff. Like mm-hmm. you're allowed to go intravenous, you're allowed to do cricothyroidotomies, like, and depending on what your medical officer is going to let you get away with, you can do even more than that. And then you get out as a civilian and you're qualified to be an EMT basic level, which means you can drive the ambulance.
Yep. And like, set up, take vitals. That's about it.
And that's it. And
yeah, like, I helped PAs and surgeons in surgery, like help amputate a leg. I popped hemorrhoids for like,
You got the badge, man.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. Ingrown toenails multiple times, helped suture dozens of times. Crazy different medications. Yeah. A lot of pretty crazy stuff. And then literally come out and they're like, yeah, you can take this Zoll monitor, hook up a blood pressure cuff and press a button. And I'm like,
yeah,
that's it. And they're like, yeah. And then I remember like after I got hired on with my department, it was within like the first 2 weeks or so. They have SAM splints on the back of the box to help splint whatever fracture comes their way. But typically what our guys do and what most paramedics do in the field in civilian medicine is we have these vacuum mattresses. And so it's like kind of like a tarp material that's full of air and like beads. You wrap it around the leg and then you vacuum out all the air. And so it creates a pretty rigid cast in a way. And that's all they do is they just tarp it, kind of like a little blanket around whatever fracture, pull it out, acts as like a little splint, and then you move them. And this lady broke her knee from just falling. And so it was already bent. They couldn't straighten it out and you couldn't really splint it in that angle. And they're like totally at loss of what they could do. And I'm like, you guys have SAM splints, right? And they're like, well, yeah, but we don't use those things. They're like from the Vietnam era. And I'm like, let me show you. And I like whip up this whole thing and they're like, all right, you're who we need on trauma calls. And I'm like, I don't know anything about diabetics or geriatrics, but give me trauma. I'll be good. So,
oh yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty funny. And then like the next call, they're like, hey, take a glucose for me with the glucometer. And I'm like, what's that? Like, I had no idea. I got to take sugar for somebody.
Yeah.
It's pretty funny.
Yeah. Like medications. Like when I went through that with the medic course, the 60-day whiskey course, like medications and like drip rate and all that just went way over my head. I learned enough to pass the test. And then, bro, I'm especially now that I'm out.
Yeah.
Like, just, you know, data dump out.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. That's how my brain works too. As soon as I don't need it, it's gone. And like, it's gone, long gone.
But you put a pig in front of me with a gunshot wound and I can put a tourniquet on its chest, you know.
But good to go. Good to go. On its chest. Yeah. I think that's the good way to go.
Yeah.
So on this deployment, you wrote where they meet. I helped you out with the cover design. So we talked a lot before you actually put it out. I really appreciate that. It was fun working with you on that. I always enjoy those. And obviously a lot of it is dedicated to your son and kind of passing the torch or at least sharing your story with him so he kind of knows who you are and what you've gone through. I guess while you're deployed, it was easy for your mind to kind of be wrapped around that theme, or was that kind of your intention before you started, or is that just what developed naturally?
No, it's just like I spend a lot of time writing to my wife and kids. Like I have a notebook for each of them. I used to write them notes every day.
Oh,
but I just figured it was easier to just have a notebook for each of them. And then when I'm gone, or even, I mean, I've been doing it since I've been home. Every day I'll write a little 4-line note to one of them. And then keep it in a notebook. And then if I do get called up for another deployment, then I just drop, you know, I can leave the notebooks and they know that I was thinking about them.
That's cool. That's
so really, I'm used to writing to my family, especially, you know, like I have a lot of guidance for my kids that, you know, they may or may not listen to as they grow up. stuff about, you know, like how to, you know, grow up in the following Christ. And then a lot of love for my wife, make sure, you know, reassure that she always knows that, you know, I'm still in love with her, you know, more so than ever.
So
marriage and the family has been, you know, a huge, huge purpose for me. So like getting out of the military, that kind of saved me.
Yeah.
Transition was not an easy one, if it's a transition at all, mm-hmm. because I got out of the Marine Corps and I went to contracting. And so I went from carrying a long gun in Iraq and Afghanistan to carrying a long gun in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
You know,
just a different, so, just somebody else's name on the, or different name on the paycheck, pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah. Pretty much. And the paycheck was significantly fatter.
Well, that's good to hear.
It was stupid. Like,
yeah. Stupid money.
Yeah. It was awesome. But so, while I was deployed on one of my contracting deployments, I had this like coming to Jesus, you know, the metaphorical, what just happened to me? Like I've survived these deployments with the military and with contracting, and I'm not sure what to do with all this stuff that's in my head, you know? And so I'd rehash over all kinds of things that happened. We had a really rough deployment in Afghanistan. That's where the picture in the book comes from. The flag raising was my platoon, scout snipers in a 3rd Battalion, 7th Marine Regiment, call sign Shadow. So, shout out to you guys if you're out there listening. We had a great deployment and a really rough one because we lost somebody that I think had he continued life, he would have been a legend. People would have read about him anyway. His name was Claudio Patino, and we lost him, and it really impacted me because he was the best of us. I was his team leader, but that guy was the heart and soul. He was the one actually running it. It was kind of annoying sometimes, or a lot of times, when I would say, "Yeah, we got to do this," and they'd look at Patino. And like, "All right, yeah, I mean, he knows what he's doing. He's that good." He would do like snapshots, like, "Hey, there's a guy out there and he's shooting a machine gun." He'd plop, "What's the range? 1,000 yard. No wind? Okay, bam!" And he'd nail a guy's center chest. He was just like, he was that quick, that good. Like a completely lethal human being. Yeah. But he was really fun to be with. He was a good dude.
Yeah. You know?
So we lost him, and I was the team leader, and we all had to, everyone on the team had to deal with that loss. And it was terrible. But everyone was able to pick up and move on. I eventually got hurt a few days later and got sent home. And, I wrote a poem, Purple Heart, about it. And it's like, I got hurt doing something dumb. I don't have a cool story for, getting banged up, but they still give me a medal. And I remember being on the plane flying to Germany from Afghanistan. And I'm in the same plane as dudes missing limbs that are still on a morphine drip. I'm like, man, I do not deserve to be on the plane with you people.
Yeah.
You guys are, whatever happened to you, you gave something, I was just dumb. And they gave the same medal to a guy in my platoon named Murphy, who got hit in the face with shrapnel in the middle of a firefight. He fell down. And I was like, "Oh, Murph's down," like a classic moment. And then he pops back up and puts his hand on his face. "I'm not dead." And then he gets up and starts fighting. It was awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
But moments like that, and the loss of one of our guys that was so integral to our unit was soul crushing. And I wasn't able to deal with it then, so I just continued on. And thank God those guys had the leadership they did, because they actually continued on under the leadership of a new platoon sergeant that took over after I left. That he led them to, I would just say, he led them to glory. Those dudes, man, 16 guys in the battalion just mopped up. It was insane what they were able to do under that leadership. So. But then I was, I had to deal with all these thoughts in my head, and the realization that so many things that I blamed other people for, were my fault. And then having to deal with the responsibility of being a team leader in charge when one of your men loses his life, and then having to, go and talk to the family after that, which was their family's all but adopted the entire platoon.
Mm-hmm.
The Patinos have been great to us, but, It was just very hard. I got to the point where I was, you got that little siren song, you're walking around armed all the time, and you're sitting in your room alone with your little pistol, and you're like, "Oh, maybe it's time to end it, dude." And just, you're thinking about it, like, "I don't know if I can do it, man. I don't know if I can do it." And honestly, my faith in God was like what saved me, that and the knowledge that I needed to come back to my wife.
Yeah.
Just those two things were just the only things that were able to pull me out of it. Because I would have done it, man. It was a dark time. Yeah. And your listeners, I know exactly what I'm talking about. So many guys have been through that, just those really dark moments. And it does pass, man. It really does.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
So within that, you're saying your faith and your wife, what was there, like an instant moment that pulled you out of that? Or was it you just never mustered up the strength to go through with it in a way? Was there like an aha moment, like, "Yep, I'm kind of over that thought," or was it just a lingering thing that kind of always just floated on you and then just eventually passed?
I think it might have been more of a selfish thing, and whatever it was, I'm glad it happened, but I didn't want another man in my house. I didn't want to relinquish that. I had to keep that. And I didn't want, another man raising my children, another man loving my wife. That's, that's just something I wasn't willing to let happen. And I know that if you have kids, then they're exponentially higher, their chances of suicide are exponentially higher if one of their parents does it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
It's just, family, and then, knowledge that this is not what God wants. This is not honor God whatsoever.
No.
So,
No, not at all. And, Well, I'm glad to hear that you didn't have the quote unquote courage, which in my opinion,
we joke about it, but you know what I mean. Like, I was like, I don't know if I could do it.
Well, so yeah, it's hard for me to say because I have my opinions of it and everything, and everybody has their opinions of it. And again, I'm just glad you didn't. And selfishly or not, I think you did it for the right reasons because family is the most important thing, and the responsibility of being a father and a husband is, in my opinion, like our duty as men. Our job always comes second or third, really, after God and family. So anything that we experience at our job, again, that should always come after the joy you feel with your wife and your kids.
Yeah,
and the joy with your wife and kids should always overshadow any kind of pain that you feel in any other aspect of your life.
Yeah, that's one thing. Like, I'm really struggling with the concept of masculinity in America because I think it's very lacking. And mm-hmm. I don't want to be one of those guys that jumps on that bandwagon. But people say, you know, men shouldn't have to be stoic and shouldn't have to be tough and strong. You know, you should be okay with not being okay. And I think that's ridiculous. I think that's patently false.
Yeah. Keith and I talk about it a lot. And I think you were actually one of the few who messaged me when I had the conversation with Dan the Barbarian on his podcast. But I think being able to have the strength to say something is extremely important, to ask for help and all that. But to kind of, I don't know, be proud that you're broken is not something to be proud of, in my opinion. And I don't ever want to shame anybody. But I don't think it's okay to be unhealthy. And so don't be proud to be unhealthy. Find a way to become healthy. It's like the most polite way I can say it.
It's a funny dichotomy because the guys who actually need help aren't going to ask for it. And the guys that, you know, are kind of, they're just holding two compasses together and can't figure out why they're pointing inward. And they're just wandering around themselves the entire time. Those are the guys that do ask for help.
Yeah.
And yeah, they should ask for help. They absolutely should. I'm not saying never ask for help, but by it.
No. You know,
that's anathema. But yeah, it's funny how the guys that need it the most just don't ask for it.
Yeah. And I think for the most part, those guys come to solutions, whether that's on their own or through their friends, with them indirectly asking or having conversations that maybe shine a little bit of light on what they're experiencing. And then those true connections, those true relationships are able to pull it out of them and everything. But
yeah,
you got to actually have those conversations. That's the healing process, is having the conversations, not posting about it or constantly sharing about it, but having in-depth conversations with people where you're able to share that with me. And then I'm able to share my experiences that I feel relate to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's just where the bonds grow. And then we don't feel so alone in this world, because that's not the case at all.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. Well, we keep on going with that because I could really go heavy into that. But I'm glad to hear that you stepped away from that and you diverted your focus on the two most important aspects of life. And so, yeah, we'll keep going right back into where they meet. And so with that, I think I did send you a message saying how much I appreciated you being confident in your faith, because that's something that I've always struggled with. I wasn't raised Christian per se. We went to church on Easter and Christmas and all that. And my mom was always like, I'm spiritual, not religious and stuff. And I never really understood that until I got older, and religion and having a relationship with Christ in itself and spirituality, all of those are actually different. And my faith has only really, really developed within the past couple years. But within that, my biggest struggle is being confident in it and speaking to people who don't really have the same faith. So for you to publicly put it out there, for you to shout it, I really appreciate that.
Well, the thing is, like,
but without being overbearing too.
Well, I'm not really publicly doing it because my real name is attached to it. It's because I've got the name Koki, and so I try to avoid as much as I can, you know, controversial posts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just a dude that writes poems. That's all I am.
Yeah.
And if I can't put my real name on it, there's no point in posting something that's going to cause a fight. I just think that's cowardly. However, comma, yeah, it, my faith in Christ is something I'm just not going to keep quiet. It's just integral to everything that I am. So it's going to come out a lot.
Yeah. No, I'm glad it did. And
I put more of my political. You can see my political leanings in the poetry. It bleeds out just like anybody else.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's what poetry's for.
Yeah,
and writing in general.
So there's a lot of poets out there that are, their poetry is centers around, I've lost my innocence in this war, and really questioning, why did we go? And was it worth it? You know, I lost so many friends, and here's what it's done to me. Here's what I'm doing while I'm still at home, not even at war, and was it all worth it? And those are very, very valid points. And I've written about that significantly. But for this book, I decided to go with a different kind of leaning. Like, there's another side to it that says, you know, I saw so many amazing things in combat. I thought I was going to be one of the amazing things, but as it turns out, I was just an okay dude in combat. That, you know, I just kind of, you know, I had my up moments and I had my down moments and I had plenty of those. But I saw so many great men, like guys like Claudio, and I wrote about a dude named Daniel, and one of my poems to one of my poems was about this guy Daniel that died. He was another scout sniper. He was a Christian as well, and our parents and our wives were both praying for our safety, and he didn't make it. Like, he died. And I had to really wrestle with that, but the realization that, you know, you can pray all you want, but, you know, in the end, your life is God's, and he's going to say yes or no. But that was a great man. Like, if you got to know this guy, he was a great, great man. Daniel Clay, and another guy named Andy Stevens. I named my son after all these guys. And, you know, great men, and I see so many funny things, too. Like, funny stories in combat. Like, these are, where else are you going to find stuff like this, man?
Oh, no, you're not going to find it anywhere else.
Yeah.
I guess the closest is, the easiest relation that I know is the firehouse, but it still pales in comparison.
Any kind of first responder job is going to have kind of the same thing.
But it really does pale, like, in comparison. And I guess what, it's always funny, because not to get too deep in it, but it's like, I'm with a bunch of conservative guys in my department and stuff, and they always want to talk about, like, America being the land of the free. And, like, I want to believe it, but I'm like, you know, where you're free in a way is being an American in Afghanistan, because you rule the land. You can do whatever the hell you want. You can, like,
Jolly Green Giants with guns.
Yeah. I'm like, that's where I felt the most free in my entire life. Like, and I was under the thumb of the army, but we were able to do whatever. If that guy said it was okay, literally one dude, we were good. And if we could hide it from that one dude, we were good. So, like, it was it, you know? And so, like, that's the only place you can get away with some of the stuff that we're allowed to do, I guess.
Yeah. And it was like, I wrote a poem called Hilarious, like, H-E-L-L-arious. It's about that. Like, everyone talks about it. So, you know, don't go to war, man. It's going to be bad for you. And I'm like, dude, you don't even know what I saw there, man. There was some funny stuff there.
Yeah.
There's some funny stuff that happened.
And it definitely twists your humor. Like, I feel bad for my wife, and I even feel bad for Keith at times too, because, like, he has pretty twisted humor with me as well. But whenever he gets to tell me stuff, I just start laughing. I'm like, I'm sorry. I know this is serious. Or same thing with my wife. And I'm like, I can really see the comedy in other people's tragedies, and I feel terrible for it. But it's just like, it has given me a much bigger appreciation for things can always be so much worse. And that's probably one of the best things combat has ever given me.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, just the things that you get to see as well, just like things that are out of the ordinary. I wrote an article for OAF Nation called Outsourcing, a rant. And it was just how we,
I read that one. Yep.
Yeah.
Go in depth. What was it about again?
Well, basically, the thing that I noticed about Americans is that we outsource everything. Like, not only do we outsource our violence,
mm-hmm.
when we outsource our violence, we outsource it to the police, because we say the state has the ability, you know, the sole ability to commit violence on my behalf. I'm paying taxes, so they are keeping me safe. And we do the same with the military. But even those guys will you know, even the government will subcontract.
Yep.
Like contractors, you know, we're outsourcing, and then they're outsourcing, and we outsource even our experiences. We outsource our culture to the point where, you know, all you have to do is go to NFL.com or whatever sports ball thing you want, and you can buy a jersey and, you know, be part of a, you know, a quote unquote brotherhood.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that goes into more real, you
know? That's a little more real. And there's a poem that I wrote called Metaphors that was in Love and War, the yep. first volume. And that's what that was about, was, you know, we can't just do like or as, like, it's, you know, life is like a war, you know, it's the ultimate metaphor. And, you know, even actors will use war as the ultimate metaphor for whatever they're talking about, but actually going to it is something completely different, you know. And I'm not, if it sounds like I'm glorifying war and I'm glorifying combat, that's what I'm doing. That's exactly
what I'm doing. Well, I think what you're also, two things. One, I'll get back to it in a second. It's not about responsibility. But second, you're also saying the words that you're attaching these meanings to actually mean something. They have a definition. And within that definition, they actually have feelings and emotions and events that are attached to them, that the only way that you truly understand them and the definition of is to experience them, like war. When you say war, yeah, it becomes something very vague. And I think that's what you kind of alluded to within that outsourcing article, if I remember correctly, is you kind of put it up on this pedestal of this imaginary thing when you put it towards, well, marriage is war, or dealing with a patient is war, dealing with your neighbors is a war, whatever, dealing with the left or the right, that's a war. And it's like, no, war in itself is its own freaking beast, and the only thing that's like war is war. And so yeah, words have definitions, and they have experiences and meanings attached to them that I think people lose sight of. And we're very, very, very good at changing words and definitions over time, which is something I want to talk to you about in a second.
Well, it's very George Orwell of our culture to redefine the term warrior,
yeah,
in whatever we want it to, you know, and it loses its entire meaning.
Yeah, well, all right, well, we're already in it, so we'll go on to one of my favorite writers, C.S. Lewis, which I'm sure you've read plenty of as well. Within Mere Christianity, the very first, I guess, chapter introduction, he talks about the word gentleman and what gentleman used to mean. And gentleman back in whatever days literally just meant somebody who wore the coat of arms of whatever knighthood or whatever family they were under. That person was a gentleman, but only when they were wearing that coat of arms. As soon as they took it off, they were just whoever. But a gentleman was somebody who was wearing that coat of arms. And then within wearing that coat of arms, they acted kind of accordingly to that. And they acted gentleman-like. Well, over time, we say, oh, that person's a gentleman because he acts a certain way. Where we have changed the meaning of that word gentleman into something what it represents rather than what it actually is. And then C.S. Lewis goes into talking about that's what we've done with what a Christian is. A Christian in itself is accepting Christ as your savior. That's what it is. But now we have over time saying people are Christian-like because they act a certain way. There's a lot of us Christians who are bad Christians, but we still accept Christ as our savior. And then you can kind of get into weeds of all that. And so there's good and bad, and that's what's important with it. But you can't just say somebody's a Christian and you expect them to be perfect, because that's far from the truth.
yeah.
And he really goes into the thick of that. So one of my top recommendations of reading Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis.
I tried to read that, but it was one of those books where I had to put it down after every page and be like, wow, that was like every word had so much meaning to it that I had to, yeah. I was like, I can't process this. Oh, it's
a lot.
It is a lot. It's a very, it's just an amazingly written book. And there's another, if we're going down the same vein, George Orwell wrote a paper or a an article or whatever you want to call it, about called something like Politics and English Language, but we talk about the same thing. Okay. How politicians in general will take a word and they will weave it into their own narrative to get people to, you know, support them.
Okay.
Eventually the words themselves lose their meaning through this, and he does it way more way better than I could.
Yeah.
It's an amazing piece for me to Politics and English Language by George Orwell.
Well, yeah, no, and that's what I think that both of them are getting at is, like I said before, these words have meanings, they have definitions, and as soon as we start detracting what those meanings and definitions are, then that's where we become pretty much prisoners of subjectivity, and that's where we're at right now, is anything and everything is meaningless, or anything and everything has every meaning possible. And yeah. So there's no, within this black and white world, nothing's but gray, and we're just constantly lost in the abyss, and yeah, we're forever in chaos, which is not what, if we're getting down this road, not what God intended or what he created. And so we need structure, we need order, we need to know these defined lines, and there are things that overlap or they butt up close together, and that's where we have to kind of sort it out personally or collectively. But definitions and limitations are there within reason.
Yeah.
But going back to what I was saying, that there's two things I want to talk about is within the idea of outsourcing, we've completely pushed responsibility. And this is one of my rants that I want to go in, since we're already going on rants, is like within my field right now in the fire service, everything's all liability. The big phrase right now is CYA, cover your ass, is as long as I document it correctly, as long as I get them to sign it, as long as I did A, B, C, 3, all the way 1, 2, 3 within this algorithm of my treatment plan, I'm good. And so my thought process now, and collectively our thought process was within my department and pretty much every department within paramedicine, within medicine in itself, it's all algorithm based right now. It's all off these check boxes. Is, okay, this person is showing this symptom. Okay, do I go down this branch or this branch? And once I figure out it's not that branch, okay, I'm going to go down this one. And so you just check down these checklists, but you're operating within fear of like, did I miss something? Did they consent? Am I offending them? Am I offending them? Am I this? Am I that? And like, you're thinking way more about that within the process of treating them than you are actually treating them and diagnosing them and helping them in reality. And so we're being trained to think in the wrong way. This is at least within the fire service and paramedicine, is we're losing responsibility based off of liability and based off of just public perception of we have to act a certain way, do things a certain way, because just in case that one person ruins it all for everybody, you know. And the policy's written because of it now.
Yeah, there's a mentality that really frustrates me that I saw mostly, actually see in the corporate world, I saw a lot in the factory, saw the military a lot, but it's this concept of they need to fix this. They need to do this. They're doing this wrong. And there's not, the people that say that tend not to say, hey, I should have done this. I should have done that. Mm-hmm. They don't say, you know, like the, I need to have ownership of this issue and fix it myself, or propose some sort of solution for it. They need to fix it. So that's when you get people that are constant victims professionally, you know, at some level. Mm-hmm. I saw this especially in a factory where you have all these people that are, you know, complaining about management, and all they're doing is complaining about stuff that they could easily fix themselves.
Yep.
Like the healthcare plan wasn't good enough for them. But hey man, well, you're complaining about the healthcare plan, but you're a type 2 diabetic shoving cheesecake in your face.
Yep.
And during lunchtime, like this, you're just dumb.
Yeah. No, and that's what were these
you've given up that sovereignty.
That was that, say it again?
You've given up that sovereignty, that's thing that like that yeah. Ownership of the issues.
No, yeah, and we're pushing personal responsibility away, and I'm not the best at being the person who gives it, but I personally receive it really well, is it's the shame in some sense, the guilt, you know, like that was one of the best tools of learning within the military. Is I had some NCOs who just rode me so hard and made fun of me and gave me shit and just made me feel worthless. But I hated feeling that way. And so what I did,
talk about shame.
Yeah.
I mean, if I wasn't made ashamed, I would never have known that a high and tight is a terrible haircut.
Yeah, no, so exactly.
For sure. I felt my first year in the Marine Corps and I was like all moto. Like I was like, oh, I just graduated School of Infantry. I'm an 0300. You know, you made it. And I showed up with my own handmade high and tight. And all my seniors like just lost their minds. I mean, like, take your cover off. Doc, look at this. And the corpsman came over and looked at me and started throwing up.
Jesus. That's awesome.
Yeah, it was brutal, man. Like, yeah, shame. I think shame is a useful tool as well.
It definitely can be. And there's the thing, like, all right, yeah, don't be a dick in a way, but you have to do it to the right people and for the right reasons and all that. Yeah,
that's where your brothers come in. Only your brothers.
Yeah.
Can do that where you know that they're doing that for your benefit. Like, if they give me a lot of grief, like maybe I shot really bad on the range one time. Like, there's one time where I shot sharpshooter, which I'm not sure. Is it sharpshooter in the army? Is like, yeah. Second?
Yep.
Yeah, I got sharpshooter as a sniper.
Yeah.
You know, I had a bad day and I couldn't get my head out of my gun or whatever. And, so I was relentlessly mocked, as I should have been.
Mm-hmm.
There was just no excuse. There's no reason for me, you know, for that kind of thing. So, man, you can bet I went out and bought an AR-15 and I went, you know, got a range membership and I was shooting every weekend. Trying to fix the problem, and yep. I got better. So yep. Shame works.
It really does. Like I said, or like you said, coming from your brothers, knowing that's coming from the right place, is what's important. And that's what's really hard for me to understand a lot of the times is like, where has this brothership gone? Like within America in itself, or within community in itself? It's like we find it in the military. I find it within the fire service. I find it with my neighbor next door. But like, where did this, and maybe the internet, social media is what's kind of distanced us or something, but it's like everybody's strangers in a way. And so it's like, if you're saying something rude to somebody, they automatically take it as like 10 times as rude. And now it becomes a yelling match, or it just becomes really, really nasty and counterproductive. But it's like people just can't be wholesome and they can't just be real with one another. It's always just this kind of fake undertone within talking to people right now that you don't know until you really get to know them. And I don't know if it's always been like that or if that's just the world that I've been growing up in now recently.
I don't know, man.
Or what?
I got kind of fortunate. I've got a close, I'll call him brother. You know, we actually, we've talked about him before we started recording, was this guitar arts guy. It's the guitar player that I keep sharing on my profile that he's in the National Guard as well. He's an officer though, so he's, you know, making the big bucks.
Yeah.
But he's got a master's degree in classical guitar. And that's crazy. He's also like a jujitsu, you know, ninja or whatever, you know, whatever they call those guys, you know.
Yeah. Ninja's probably right.
Yeah, he deadlifts like, you know, he's 165 pounds and he deadlifts over 450.
Yeah, nice.
Just a, you know, interesting guy. But yeah, so like we connect really well, and we had the same faith, we had the same views on politics and everything. So so I got kind of lucky there.
Yeah, no, that's good. That's really good.
Yeah.
I guess where I was going a little bit more is just people that you don't know and creating those relationships kind of out of nowhere. It's like people are really guarded, and obviously this COVID stuff isn't helping, but people are really guarded unless you find that kind of mutual understanding, that thing that really kind of unites you, or mutual even friend really that kind of gets the ball rolling. But I feel like a lot of us are a lot more alike than we like to give us credit for.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I think that one of the issues with an atomized population is that, you know, people are trying to create a tribe. People want that connection. They try to create a tribe by themselves. And a lot of times it's just, especially with men, it ends up devolving into a drinking group.
Because
they all get together and drink beers, and that's all it turns into, as opposed to let's go out and do something meaningful. So, you know, you find some sort of identity that you guys all share, whether that be, you know, your faith or maybe some, you know, the jiu-jitsu guys, some, for some reason, find this a lot.
Yeah, they're really good at it.
Yeah. So I might start looking into getting one of those things, but the, you know, they're fighting the geese and stuff, and it's looks super hot, man.
I did it for a couple months. It going the no gi style. I was better at right off the bat wearing that gi, and then those guys knowing how to use it against you. They ball you up quick.
It's just not fair, man. You're using my sleeve to choke me out.
Yeah. It gets pretty embarrassing. Like, I overpowered a guy without one, and then immediately with one, like, my power meant nothing. He just knew how to maneuver my whole body and use it against me. And I was like, yeah, screw you.
Yeah, I was on contract with this, I don't know, he's a jiu-jitsu god. And he's like 150 pounds. He eats nothing but fish and vegetables. This, like, real lean dude. But he's built for jiu-jitsu. Like, all his muscles are in his neck and his forearms.
Yeah. Back.
And so he'll take you, and his 150 pounds feels like 200 when it's his kneecap on your sternum.
Yep.
And then, like, dude, did you just choke me out with my pants? I don't even know how you did that.
No, it's pretty impressive what those guys can do. I really want to get back into it too, but it's expensive. That's honestly the biggest reason why I don't do it. I think there's some really, really, really good places around here that I just gotta do it. But I don't know if there's much else that we needed to add on to. You really talked about what got you back into this writing, the people that have kind of influenced you into that. We talked about your faith, which is what I really wanted to do. Is there any more that you want to talk about within the veteran community in itself, whether that's this GWA era?
Well, I think there's one thing I got to realize is there's a lot of, for some reason, I became a guy that people come to for poetry advice, which is bizarre to me. Like, I'd never thought I'd be the poetry guy.
Mm-hmm. You
know? Like, people coming to me for advice, and there was actually a dude that sent me his work today, and I'm like, bro, you shouldn't be coming to me for advice. This is awesome. I should be asking, how did you do this?
Yeah.
And there's a lot of guys that are really getting into writing. Mostly, some of them will publish it, and some of them won't. But I think writing is just such a useful tool. I like poetry in particular. It used to be, I thought, the language of warriors, you know. Mm-hmm. Poetry was a way for people to express through song, through verse, you know, exploits in combat and the things that they did for their land and their people. And for right or wrong, it's got more of a sissy, you know, connotation to it, which I think is completely false. And I wish people would look into it more, because it's such a hard thing to master. Mm-hmm. to take a thought and explain it in verse. What I see a lot of people doing, especially, like, and I did this too, especially starting out, is I would just take a sentence or a few sentences, and then I would just hit enter a whole bunch of times until it looked like a column of words.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't even a poem. It was just a sentence that was broken up.
Yeah.
So figuring out how to do poetry into an actual verse, mm-hmm, where each line has its own meaning, and then going into rhyme, that was a challenge in of itself, because what I found is that I would chase a rhyme a lot.
Yeah.
I would, okay, what rhymes with, you know, what rhymes with gun? Fun rhymes with gun. Okay, now I've got to find a verse that says fun at the end.
Yeah.
You know, it would sound like garbage.
Yeah.
So chasing the rhyme, something that was like, it's a hard habit to break.
Yeah.
And what really blew my mind is when I started working with meter. The iambic pentameter, trochaic, you know, the tetrameter, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That was really hard for me to do, but it was fascinating to me, because, and it's funny, the way I really got turned on to it was, if you ever watch the show Archer,
yep.
Yeah, so there's a scene where the big fat girl, what's her name? Is it Pam?
Yeah. I know who you're talking about. I can't think of her name right now.
Tattoo on the back, on her back.
Yes. Yep.
And I was like, what is that? What is that? You know, I got to figure out what that is. And it turns out it's a section of a poem from, who's the fellow that wrote She Walks in Beauty Like the Night? George Gordon Lord Byron.
Okay.
He wrote a collection called the Hebrew Songs, which is like talking, you know, talks about song, you know, stuff in the Bible.
Yeah.
And it's this one poem about the siege of Jerusalem, and it's the line is, and the angel of death spread his wings on the blast, and it goes on to this whole thing, and it was the tetrameter or the trochaic meter, which is like a 3-4 thing, as opposed to a 4-4 or 2-4. That was the rhythm of his words, mm-hmm. which he said he did that because it has a battle feel to it. It sounds like horses galloping. I was like, bro, that just blew my mind. So I had to start doing, like, I got to figure out how to do that now. And when I wrote the poem that I wrote that was the hardest for me was the one called Dead Body. And mm-hmm. I saw a dead body, you know, in wartime, and I wrote about it. And mm-hmm. so I will have like a verse, like a stanza of four lines, and it'll have the iambic, the 2-4 thing. And then that'll be the thing that's going on in my head. And then I'll switch to a 2-line section, a 2-line stanza that's in the 3-4, the trochaic time. Yeah. And so that's because that's the battle thing for me, because it's got the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That's the stuff that's going on as all this is happening in my head. So like, for instance, it says like a funeral, I thought it'd be closed ties, hands clasped, a look of peace. It was nothing that sophisticated. He was just a sack of skin deflated.
Mm-hmm.
And the bullet snapped by so close over my head, but time has now stopped and I stare at the dead.
There you go.
On underneath. So they switching from rhythm to rhythm.
Yep.
A really fun challenge.
Yeah. Oh man, I love hearing you talk about it. I see the passion.
Dude, what really blew my mind is when I found out that like rhythm and poetry, that's what rap means.
Yeah.
Like I didn't know. I didn't know
the word. Yeah.
So like all these dudes, like when rap first started happening, it was just dudes reading poetry to a beat.
Yep.
And you listen to someone like listen to Rap God by Eminem, or you listen to anything by Tupac. I started listening to Tupac recently, which I never thought I'd listen to that. I'm a metal guy. I'm listening to Tupac. I'm like, bro, this is insane poetry.
Yeah.
Like it's really hard to do.
Yeah. No, that's something that we've nerded out a couple times on the podcast. Is that's what Dead Reckoning has been about, is to change this narrative of the transition from the stoic figures writing poetry and it being cool to now it being soft. And it's like, no, it's not soft. It can be, I guess, but we're not that, and we want to be able to brand it accordingly.
It should be. I've got poetry to my daughters in here. And it's the definition of softness.
Mm-hmm.
I got poetry to my son, the same way, same poetry. I got some poems to my wife. I got several to my wife. Good grief. That woman is worth all the poetry, but there's a time and a place for everything. And sometimes when you're talking about an experience where you want to convey an emotion or something, well, poetry is just distilled words. Mm-hmm. Where you're trying to pick each single word that's going to have the most meaning and the most impact. And then like if a novel is like beer, poetry is whiskey, you know.
Yeah.
It's just packed with it. Packed. Yeah. Or mescaline, or you know, pick your drug of choice.
I think we're gonna have to quote you on that one.
Poetry is whiskey of words.
Yep.
Put down a t-shirt or you know, something.
Hell yeah. Well, I like it. I like it a lot.
I'll give $100 to the first person that puts a tattoo on their body that says that.
Well, man, you already got one tattoo dedicated to Strength and Strife, I think is what it was.
Yeah, so it was a guitar slurts.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I sent him that poem like a long time ago. And I was like, dude, what do you think about this? And he's like, dude, I love that last line where it talks about we find strength for our strife and strife for our strength.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's that you have to find something to struggle against, especially in this world where there's, you know, the struggles are, we have to invent them.
Mm-hmm. Almost. Yep.
We build gyms so that we can invent our own struggle.
Yeah.
Just something to do. But yeah, so. Yeah, he got that tattooed on there. So sorry, dude, you already did it. That doesn't you don't get the money.
Yeah, no, that's pretty cool. That's really really cool. It's been awesome to know that we're part of your growth and part of the growth within this community. And getting you on here and talking to you when I know that this is only the beginning for you, and we're excited about it.
Well, it's been great being part of everything you guys have been doing as well. And I wish Keith could have been here. I really want to pick his brain about the hardcore scene.
Yeah.
I don't understand it.
Like, I know. I told him.
He sent me several like links and stuff. Like, hey man, check this out. Just don't get it, man. Yeah. I look at Black Flags and it sounds like a bunch of chimps screaming about the government. That's all I hear, man. Like, I mean, like I said, I'm a metal guy, which to me, metal is just angry math. Like, especially like thrash or like Meshuggah or something like that. Yeah. But it's just like, you got this really complicated drum beats, and the guitar's playing a different rhythm entirely, but it all meshes together. It's just angry math. Like you gave a huge, like a cycle of Decca to Stephen Hawking or somebody.
Yeah.
Just got some mathematician on a cycle of D-ball.
Yeah. No.
Why it's called a scene, I don't understand. We'll have to explain it to me sometime because I just don't get it.
I know right before we got on the call and he called me saying he was going to miss it. I told him that you wanted to talk to him about that. And he's like, oh, shit, that would have been pretty good to hear. So y'all have to get on the phone sometime and talk about it, because I didn't grow up in that scene. I didn't grow up in the metal scene either.
I didn't either. I grew up in like DC Talk. And
Yeah, no, I didn't grow up in that either. But it's and they're always, it's like a whole personality and mindset. Like, you meet him and then his friends and then my friends that are part of that scene that never met him. It's like they all kind of carry the same kind of, I don't know, it's like a brand image as well. And like, even in their 30s and almost 40s, it's like, that's still definitely part of them. And I love it. It's awesome.
I get the impression that somebody who has a Black Flag tattoo is very likely to enjoy Bukowski.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
I like Bukowski. To me, I don't get the appeal. To me, he's just a drunk dumpster fire.
I like some of his stuff, but the big rave about him, I've always just been like, it's good, and that's about it. I'm like, yeah, I like it, but I don't.
It's not a rip. I know that. I mean, he is so famous, and everybody loves him so much. I must not have read the right things. Like, yeah. I haven't read Amon Rye. I know that's one of his books, and I haven't read that. So I might have to, you know, knuckle down and buy that thing and like try to figure this out, like really, really unpack this.
You may not want to waste your time. Just stick to the stuff that you already like and know.
Yeah, I mean, Walt Whitman's kind of my guy.
I just picked up some Faulkner that I'm interested in kind of start digging into. But yeah, no, it's always good to just. What's cool about the veteran community and now within this writing community is the different personalities that we've met throughout all of this, and they all bring something different to the table. They all have these different backgrounds, all these different interests, but the reading and the writing is what unites us, and then that critical thinking, that's what it's all about, and then the good conversations that always come with it.
Yeah, I would never have run into well, you guys or any of the other guys that was writing, I just idolize, idolize. And I would never run into you if I hadn't tried to dive into it.
Yeah, no, it's been fun. And we're only at the beginning of it, man. I promise you that. I'm excited for the ride.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to volume two.
Oh, yeah, that's it's coming. Okay, yeah. I can't give too much away, but it's coming.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, we're going to have a good time with it. And same thing with any of your other works coming out there. Let us know if we can help you in any way.
Awesome, man. Well, you've definitely done quite a bit already. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, we appreciate you having on. You take care of yourself, all right? Is there any way that anybody can get your books, find you, read some of your other works, and all that good stuff, all the good plugs?
Yeah, all right. So capitalism. All right, so if you're gonna buy the books, you can get it on Amazon. And if you're not in the United States or you're not an American soldier deployed to an APO or FBO, whatever address, I would recommend getting on Amazon. You can also go to kokiactual.com. That's where I sell all my books are signed copies. So anything you buy from kokiactual.com is sent directly from me, and they're all signed just as a thank you. Like, I really appreciate anybody who's willing to fork over their own hard-earned cash just for some, you know, some chicken scratch that I wrote.
And then the Instagram handle is just
@Cokie_actual.
So we'll put it all in the descriptions and get you people and get people there.
Awesome sauce and Q Mattis.
The biggest, I think, the biggest misperception is that somehow we're damning you. But nothing really can stop us.